Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to today's podcast. Today, we're going to talk about happiness. So let's start with a true-false test. I'll tell you a supposed fact about happiness, and you decide whether you think it's true or false. Okay? One, unexpected pleasures are the most rewarding. True or false? Two, novelty in a relationship has similar effects on our brain as a high from drugs. True or false? Three, daily hassles impact our well-being more than major life events. Daily hassles impact our well-being more than major life events. True or false? Four, when it comes to sex, women require more novelty than men. Women require more novelty than men when it comes to sex. True or false? Five, the genes that underlie who gets divorced, the genes, by the way, that underlie who gets divorced are passed down from parents to children. True or false? Six, a smoking habit is not a bigger risk factor for heart disease than a troubled marriage. A smoking habit is not a bigger risk factor for heart disease than a troubled marriage. True or false? And finally, number seven, renters are happier than homeowners. True or false? Renters are happier than homeowners. Okay, let's see how you did. Well, it turns out, according to today's guest, all seven statements are true. Yep, renters are happier and women want more novelty and sex than men. So where do I get off making those assertions? It's all based in science. Today's guest, Sonia Lyubomirsky, professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, is one of the nation's top students of happiness. And we're going to talk today about the findings in her new book, The Myths of Happiness, what should make you happy but doesn't, and what shouldn't make you happy but does. Here in Freeform, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, culture, happiness, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Originally from Russia, Sonia Lyubomirsky received her AB summa cum laude from Harvard University and her PhD in social personality psychology from Stanford University. Not too shabby. Her research has been awarded a Templeton Positive Psychology Prize, a Science of Generosity grant, a John Templeton Foundation grant, and a $1 million grant from the National Institute of Mental Health to conduct research on the possibility of permanently increasing happiness. She's author of The How of Happiness, which has been translated and published in 19 countries, and her newest, The Myths of Happiness. Welcome, Sonia Lyubomirsky, to Free Forum.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I just did a quick bio. But could you tell us in your own words, briefly, a bit about your path to the work that you find yourself doing today? And feel free to go back to childhood if that's where something started and mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Sure. It's a good question. Well, you know, you mentioned that I was from Russia, and I came to the United States when I was 10 years old. And so one of the first things I noticed is a huge cultural difference in happiness, and at least the expression of happiness. You know, people in Russia all kind of look gloomy, and, you know, they don't talk to each other on the street. And here everyone smiles, you know, not everyone, but people smile when they walk on the street. They say hi to you, even if they don't know you. So I just remember that as kind of a formative insight.
What age was it you moved here?
Yeah. That was at age 10.
Okay.
But then, you know, when I went to graduate school at Stanford, on the very first day of graduate school, I met with my new advisor. His name is Lee Ross, and he's one of the world's experts on conflict and negotiation. Okay, so nothing to do with happiness. But for some reason, the very first day we met, we started talking about happiness. Like, what is happiness, and why are some people happier than others? But we took a walk around the campus, and that's how it all began. We kind of started talking about it. You know, back then, the study of happiness was not considered sort of a scientific topic. It was considered kind of fuzzy and unscientific. Only one person in the whole world was studying happiness at the time. His name is Ed Diener. Now things have really changed. You know, that was 20 or so years ago. Now, you know, neuroscientists are studying well-being, economists, you know, Lots of people are talking about it.
Yeah. And so from that walk around that campus and that talk, in other words, it had been something that just had been, I mean, of course, everyone kind of, you know, thinks about happiness now and then, I assume. But you got to Stanford Graduate School not knowing that's what you were going to focus on.
That's right. I did not know that.
Wow.
And then it just all started. We started very descriptively because we didn't really know anything about happiness. We started interviewing people who had been nominated to be really happy or unhappy just to kind of see what are the differences between happy and unhappy people. We started doing research. But again, back then, I actually felt kind of insecure about the research because it was such a novel topic of research.
Well, I know that one of the people who in the broader range, not necessarily looking at happiness, but in the broader range of, call it, positive psychology, I remember interviewing Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, mm-hmm. who is responsible for Flow, which we'll talk about in a bit. And he said it was based on his experiences in World War II and his life in Hungary that he wanted to find a way to work in psychology to help people be happier, let's say. Mm-hmm. But he found at that point, this was in the 50s, that that was impossible. And so he focused on creativity because that was the only area that at that point, you know, he could even, you know, begin to work in. There's been this evolution, but clearly today is a very different thing.
That's right. Yeah. And even back, you know, 20, 30 years ago, Ed Diener, who's the only researcher who was really studying happiness at the time, he didn't even call it happiness. He called it subjective well-being, which was kind of this jargon term for happiness, you know, sort of to make it sound more scientific.
Right. I'm sure that's very believable to me that he would have to do that. I mean, happiness, you don't go to school, you don't get grants, you don't get tenure for looking at things like happiness. Now, mm-hmm. we're used to the public seeing articles and quizzes, sort of like what I did at the top in the intro there, in magazines about happiness. The self-help industry, you know, abounds with motivational speakers and gurus preaching about it. Yet your work, as I said, is rooted in science. For someone who this is new to, how so? How do you study happiness?
Sure. Well, I think there's a lot of wisdom in the self-help sort of domain. But I do think that there's a special kind of sort of evidence or wisdom that you can get from science, from studying something systematically. Like, and the analogy I often make is that, for example, if you have an illness and you want to get treatment or you need to have surgery or you need to go on a drug, don't you want to make sure that that treatment or drug or that surgery has been tested, you know, so to make sure that it's effective? And so I say the same thing about happiness. Like, if you want to be a happier person, how do you go about doing it? I think it's important to not only to sort of listen to your grandmother or a motivational speaker or a clinician, but to sort of look at what the research has shown. So what I do in my research is they're called happiness interventions, and they're basically experiments to see, you know, what works to make people happier and how and why. And these experiments are kind of like clinical trials, but instead of testing a new treatment, I'm testing sort of a happiness strategy.
Okay. And you mentioned neuroscience at one point. How mm-hmm. much does neuroscience play a part in what you do or in the broader field?
Doesn't play a part in what I do at all because I'm not a neuroscientist. But happiness, positive emotions has become sort of more – a reward has become more of a topic in neuroscience. So, for example, there are scientists who are doing fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, looking at people's brains while they're, say, looking at something rewarding on a screen versus something that's punishing, sort of to see what areas of the brain light up in a sense. Richard Davidson, who's at the University of Wisconsin, is very famous for doing research looking at activity in the brain. He finds that people who are happier have an asymmetry in the frontal cortex in the front part of the brain. So the left side of the frontal part of the brain has more activity versus the right side. So this asymmetry is related to happiness and positive emotion. So there is research sort of in the field of neuroscience, but it's not so relevant to what I do because I'm not trained in that field.
Sure. I'm using you a little bit, Sonia, to give people kind of an introduction to the mm-hmm. broader field. We have an hour. We're going to deal with the specifics, but I want people to just, you know, to a lot of people, this is new stuff. And as we both have said, people I think are more used to nostrums and guidance and advice and so on, but not the fact that it's actually been, you know, that there's scientific evidence for it. Let me tell people, I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Sonia Lubomirsky about her new book, The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. And I like that subtitle. And you can learn more at drsonia.net. Rather than put you through having to copy down the spelling of Sonia's last name, she's created a simpler website, drsonja.drsonia.net. How do you, in the studies you do, quantify happiness? How does happiness itself, it seems such an intangible, such a continuum sort of thing, how do you quantify it?
Sure, sure. So, well, just because something's intangible or very subjective doesn't mean that we can't measure it. So happiness is definitely very subjective, right? Like only you know how happy you really are. I mean, we can ask your spouse or we can, I don't know, we can measure how often you smile or things like that. You know, people will look at people's emails or texts or Facebook profiles and see how many positive words they use. And those can be indicators of happiness, but they're not perfect indicators because someone could put on a show but not really be truly happy. So what we do is basically ask people directly, how happy are you? And so there are well-validated measures or scales. They are both valid and reliable. And so I ask people, you know, how happy are you overall? Say on a 7-point scale, how happy are you relative to your peers? How satisfied are you with your life? How often do you experience positive and negative emotions? So this is sort of the gold standard that researchers use in measuring happiness.
Now, you mentioned that if we instead looked at, for instance, their Facebook shares and so on, they might be putting on a show. Couldn't the same thing apply to self-evaluation in your questioning?
Yeah, that is certainly possible. This is called social desirability bias. It's socially desirable in our culture to be happy, to show happiness, and so people may be more likely to lie a little bit. There's sort of various ways we can go around it. We can collect different kinds of measures. You know, we can, you know, ask you how happy you are and ask your friends how happy they think you are and look at your, you know, at your text messages to see if they have a lot of positive words. And we find that generally people are fairly honest, especially, you know, if we give like an online questionnaire, you know, you don't really have any reason to lie, you know. No one really knows. And we also make it anonymous, so no one really knows who you are. So we kind of reduce any kind of reason for this social desirability bias to play itself out.
So in other words, while it might be at play, you've done enough other looks at this to find out that it seems to hold pretty true.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Okay. So here's the next thing. Can you describe a couple of your experiments to listeners so that they can get an idea of what you actually do to arrive at your conclusions?
That's right. Well, for example, one thing I've been studying is whether people who do acts of kindness on a regular basis become happier. So I study generosity. You know, when you're kind and generous to others, it makes you feel good. It brings you social rewards. You might make new friends. And so we do studies where we, for example, will ask people, say, for the next 6 weeks, every Monday, do 3 acts of kindness that you don't normally do. Just sort of something over and above what you usually do, kind of to help others. And then we measure your happiness before, during, after, maybe a follow-up period after. And we find that. And we also have a control group. So we randomly assign people to either do acts of kindness or do something neutral. And then we see what happens. We see, and we do find that people who do acts of kindness on a regular basis, they become happier. The control group does not become happier.
Okay. 2 questions about that. If I'm doing acts of kindness and you're asking me if I'm happier, I would think, well, they want me to be happier. If you get where I'm going, of course, you know, that this sounds like the kind of experiment where, again, we're going for that sort of bias, where if I'm playing the game with them, if I'm on their team, I'm going to be happier. How do you mitigate that kind of thing?
Right, right. No, I love these questions.
These are
very, very smart and subtle questions about experimentation.
By the way, I was a SOCREL major at Harvard.
What major?
Social relations, which was gone by the time you got there, but it was this mixture of social psychology, sociology,
right,
and social anthropology.
Well, in fact, when I was there, it was called psychology and social relations, and then I think they just got rid of the social relations.
I know.
So so great. So you're well trained. And so there's a couple of problems. One is called, I think what you refer to is called demand characteristics, which is that you think, like, it'll be obvious to you, I'm in a happiness study. The experimenter wants me to get happier, so I'm going to satisfy the experimenter by, you know, or myself by kind of, by saying that I'm happier or convincing myself that I'm happier. So one way we go around that is the control group. Usually our control group does something neutral. Like, for example, we'll ask them, every week we want you to write down everything you did this week. And it's kind of like an organizational task. We want you to try to organize your time and sort of think about how you organize your time. And we tell them this is a positive activity that makes people happier. Okay. Both the control group and the experimental group think that they're in a happiness experiment. You see what I mean?
Yes. And think that the finder, the experimenter, would probably like it if we were. Yeah.
Right. So that's one way we try to do it. Now, it's not perfect because it's not as easy to convince someone who's doing this organizational task that it's really is a happiness kind of strategy. But anyway, we try whatever we can to try to combat sort of these problems that you mentioned.
Okay. The second question, and I am going to ask you to give us one other experiment just so people can get another feel for it, is I've often thought, and having been one myself, that when we do – please tell me I'm wrong – but when we do most of this kinds of testing, that a huge percentage of our participants are college students. Mm-hmm. and college graduate students. And so what we really find out in these – most of these experiments, and you know, as I say, tell me I'm wrong, is how college students and graduate students respond in certain situations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, that's a great point. And the way we go about addressing that is we do lots of studies with not with college students, but with real people who are sort of working, who are living in the community. So we just as an example, we just finished a study with engineering workers in Tokyo. We just finished a study in Spain, people who work at Coca-Cola Spain. We just finished a study with 9 to 11-year-old kids in Vancouver. So we do plenty of studies that don't use college students. But we also do studies with college students, and you're right, that it's not a very representative sample. So if all your studies are with college students, you're in trouble.
Right. And am I correct that even today that a significant percentage of such studies, not just you, but in the whole realm of psychology and behavior and so on?
That is right. A lot of them are done with college students. But I should say that now with new technologies and the internet, that is becoming a smaller percentage. It used to be like, 90%, 80%. I think it's now a much smaller percentage.
Good. Technology wins on, helps us on this one. So describe one other experiment just so people get another sense. Something that's a bit different.
I'll describe this one that we just did in Madrid, Spain.
Sure.
Which I love. So we went to this company in Madrid. We had to translate everything into Spanish, of course. And we asked the employees in this sort of office setting. Some of the employees were asked to be what we call givers. This is a little similar to the other one because it has to do with Ask the Clients, but it's a nice study, so I'll tell you about it.
Sure.
So we asked people to be givers. So it's kind of like a secret Santa study where we ask people, we give people a list of their colleagues. So here are 10 people at your workplace. We want you to do 3 acts of kindness for them this week. But the givers did not realize that they were on these lists, okay? So we had the receivers did not realize they were on the list. So the givers did acts of kindness for receivers. The receivers were just lucky to be recipients of kindness. And then there were the observers, who was everyone else in the workplace. And this was amazing. So we found that both the givers and receivers got happier, especially the receivers. Imagine suddenly your colleagues are doing all these nice things for you. The givers had kind of a delayed reaction, and even months after the study was over, they were still more engaged in their work, they were less depressed, and there was a paid-forward effect, so the recipients of kindness started to help their colleagues more. It's kind of the paid-forward. And there's also an inspiration effect, such that kind of if you just happen to observe other people do acts of kindness for their colleagues, you start to sort of do the same as well. So we feel like we transformed the whole workplace.
Now, one thing that strikes me about, as you said, both of these were about acts of kindness or giving or generosity and so on. And it strikes me that this is absolutely one of those things that whether it's religion or grandma or, Girl Scouts or, everyone has always said, do this. I mean, this has always been a counsel. What you're doing by these experiments is actually saying it's not just an old wives' tale. It's not
right.
just grandma's wisdom. It actually works. And it sounded like in this experiment you were just describing, and it's not just about happiness. That to me it would seem some of the more interesting findings are the other things. I mean, whether it affects creativity or innovation or mm-hmm. teamwork and those sorts of things.
That's right. That's right. And in fact, research shows that when people become happier, they become more creative, their immune system becomes stronger, they become their relationships improve, they become more productive at work. So there's lots of benefits to experiencing positive emotions and happiness. But you're right that it all sounds like just common wisdom. And in fact, I sometimes get emails saying, like, everything you study is in the Bible. You know,
yeah.
The Bible tells you to be grateful and to be forgiving and to be kind to others. And I should say, I have a lot of studies that I do on gratitude, where we ask people to, like, every week write a letter of gratitude to someone who's helped you in your life. And that is a very powerful sort of producer of happiness as well. So, but yeah, it sort of sounds like common wisdom, but yet, you know, we need to test it systematically because some of these sort of could be old wives' tales. They could actually be wrong, you know. So we need to test them to make sure that they really are that they are right.
Okay, that's Sonia Lyubomirsky. She's a professor at UC Riverside. And we're talking about the whole realm of happiness, the study of happiness, and her new book, The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. And you can learn more about her work at a website, drsonja.net, and her Sonja is S-O-N-J-A, so it's drsonja.net. One thing that jumped out at me that time is we do it to say if some of these old wives' tales, some of these nostrums don't work. Have you found some that don't?
Oh, that's a very
so now question. We're getting into the sort of the myths.
Well, almost into the myths. But in terms of the interventions that I've done, what I do find is that it depends sometimes on the person. So, for example, we did a study on gratitude where we had people write gratitude letters with depressed students. Here's an example of a study we did with college students. And actually, quite a few college students are depressed, so it's easy to find them. And we found that they got less happy. So actually, when we asked depressed students to write gratitude letters, they got less happy rather than more.
No kidding.
And that was really surprising to us. And so what we realized is that it's important to kind of tailor the strategy, the pursuit, the activity to the individual. And maybe if you're too depressed, you know, when you try to be grateful, it might backfire. You might find it too difficult. You might feel guilty that, you know, you haven't expressed gratitude in the past. You might feel like there's no one in your life to be grateful for. You know what I mean? So there's lots of complications that can arise. So that's where the surprises have come in for us.
Ah, that's very fascinating to me. So although we would get to it later in the conversation, what have you found works for them?
Again, it depends. Yeah, but I think what we find is that for depressed individuals, something very simple. You know, so for example, write down three good things that happened today. Okay, so it could be very small things. So no matter how depressed you are, you can come up with, oh, it was a sunny day today. You know what I mean? Whereas like writing a gratitude letter is just it involves a lot of introspection. So something very, very simple. Maybe it's sort of the more depressed you are, the more simple you want to go.
Okay. And now, again, this is a question, Sonia, on the broad field of positive psychology. We sort of touched on it briefly at the start of the conversation, but how big is it now? How did it grow? And what are what you consider the most meaningful findings so far?
Mm-hmm. Well, so positive psychology is basically, you know, it was a field, a sort of refocusing of psychology that was kind of moved forward by Marty Seligman and Mike Csikszentmihalyi, two very famous researchers. And basically what they did is they inspired a lot of young scientists and now all kinds of scientists to not only study the negative things in life, you know, like stress or trauma or divorce or depression, mental illness, but to study the positive side of life. What makes people flourish? You know, what are people's strengths? What makes people happy? And now, and you're right, now it's a really big field. A lot of people are focusing on well-being. In fact, if you just pick up a psychology journal, you know, like a mainstream psychology journal, and just read the titles, a lot of the titles have like well-being or, you know, positive emotions in the title. And in fact, my argument is that it's no longer necessary for us to have a field called positive psychology. I don't think we need to call it anything. It's just part of psychology.
That's a real benchmark, isn't it, when you reach that point where you don't need the designation?
That's right. I don't think we need the designation. I actually don't sort of avoid calling myself a positive psychologist. I study happiness. I study generosity. I study gratitude. I study humility. You know, I'm a psychologist. You know, I'm a social psychologist. In terms of the most important findings, you know, I mean, of course, I focus on what makes people happy, how people can increase their happiness. I also study strengths as well. There's a whole area of positive psychology focused on strengths. We don't so much do it, although we have a line of research I mentioned on humility, sort of what is humility, how do you measure it, what are its benefits, how do people become more humble. We also study, as you know, generosity, but there are sort of other researchers that study other strengths. So, and lots of researchers who study positive emotions and the value of positive emotions. So, but again, this is all now, I think it doesn't have to be positive psychology.
Yeah.
It's just psychology.
Well, in terms of some of the things you've mentioned, strengths and so on, what are some of the books you recommend of others' work, for instance, on grit or some of these things, just for someone who, again, this is sort of new to, and they're going, oh, you know, this I want to get into a library.
Right, right.
Or
they
get
want to learn more.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I have kind of a variety of books that I love that have come out of positive psychologists. A couple are by Barbara Fredrickson, who studies positive emotions. She's a professor at the University of North Carolina. So she wrote a book called Positivity about the value of positive emotions. And she has a new book called Love 2.0 that hasn't come out yet. And it's about love, which is a strength. So, and I've read both of them. They're both great books. Trying to think, you know, of course, I love Mike Csikszentmihalyi's books on flow.
Yeah,
he has lots of them.
I
think they're really terrific books. He's a great writer. I really recommend reading him. Another one of my favorite books is by Barry Schwartz called The Paradox of Choice.
Yes, that's such choice. A fascinating one.
Yeah, it's a great book, and I've done some work with him as well. And he talks about how, you know, we sort of think that more choices the better, but actually sometimes choices can be overwhelming and paralyzing. I'm trying to think, you know, John Haidt's The Happiness Hypothesis is a great introduction to both the psychology and the philosophy of happiness and sort of related subjects, The Happiness Hypothesis. So Dan Gilbert's Stumbling on Happiness is
right.
About how people predict what makes them happy. Actually, that's relevant to my new book, The Myths of Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, there's tons of books.
No, but that's
there.
Great. I mean, that's very, very good. Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. How did this book happen, and why the title, The Myths of Happiness?
The Myths of Happiness. Well, my first book was called The How of Happiness, and that was about sort of how people can become happier and the science behind it. That's basically what we've been talking about so far. And I continued doing research on happiness, and one thing that really struck me is that a lot of people have the wrong idea about what they think will make them happy. And also, they have the wrong idea what they think will make them miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I decided to write a book about the myths of happiness. And the myths, there are really two categories of myths that I talk about, and I just kind of mentioned them. The first one is, so what makes you happy? Like, people think, well, I'm not happy now, but I will be happy when, you know, X, Y, and Z happen. When I get married, when I have a baby, when I get that job I've always wanted, when I strike it rich, when I move to that city I always wanted to live in, then I'll be happy. And the problem with that misconception is that those things do make people happy, but they don't make them happy for as long or as intensely as they think they will. And so I have quite a few chapters in the book about that myth. And the second myth is about things that we think will make us miserable forever. Oh, if I got a divorce, I would never recover. If I became ill, I'd be miserable forever. If I didn't find a life partner, if I didn't make as much money as I thought I needed, I'd be unhappy forever. And those are also myths as well. So,
right. And by the way, I think we all see how the first ones, everyone sort of goes, the next thing that we're trying to do. But the negative ones, I can see I'm stuck in a bad relationship, but I would be miserable if I got divorced. I'm stuck in a bad job, but I would be miserable if I weren't making this much money. That's where something like pointing out that those myths becomes really important.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, what I focus on in the book, and I have sort of different chapters on these different myths about jobs, relationships, money, illness, aging, et cetera. And I kind of point, you know, because of the, what people need to know is sort of to learn, you know, what do people really do? What do they experience when they get divorced and when they get ill or when they don't have much money? It turns out that the research shows that human beings are remarkably resilient. I mean, it's amazing. I mean, not everyone, but on average, people recover very well after divorce, for example. So, I mean, they're miserable for several years. I think the average is about for 4 to 5 years. Sort of during after divorce, you are kind of less happy than you were, but then you really rebound and then you become actually quite a bit happier than you were in that bad relationship. You know, with money, you know, it turns out that people get used to not having that much money, really simplifying their lives. I'm not talking about poverty and
right.
not having your basic needs. With aging, you know, a lot of us think like, oh my God, you know, we don't want to get old. We dread aging because we think we'll be so unhappy when we're older. It turns out the older people are happier. people who don't find a partner, single people, you know, we think we'd be miserable if we were single. It turns out single people are just as happy as married people. So anyway, so we just need to know this information. And then, you know, I'm not telling people they should get divorced or that they should not find a life partner or that they should quit their jobs. But I'm sort of giving them information they can work with and then they can make their own decisions.
Yeah, no, it sounds like one of it is the grass may actually be greener, but you won't notice it after a while.
That's right.
Okay, I'm Terrence McNally. We're at about the halfway point here. I'm speaking with Sonia Lyubomirsky. And I'm going to spell it once just for those of you who want to go Google her, okay? Lyubomirsky. So that's Lyubo and then Mirsky. And we're talking about a new book, The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't and What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does, and a website to learn more about her work. And her websites are actually very informative. I spent some time on them preparing for this. Is drsonja.net, drsonja.net. Okay, you mentioned some of the comparisons. I want to do this thing where how do certain things correlate with happiness, okay? So, and I'm going to give you one, tell me what you know. I'll give you another one, tell me what you know. Let's start with age, young versus old. What do we know about happiness?
Well, I kind of alluded to this
yep.
just a few minutes
yeah,
ago.
Yeah.
So we think that older people are less happy. Actually, the opposite is true. So probably the least happy are people who are in their 20s, sort of young people, kind of teenagers, 20s.
Mm.
We think, oh, wouldn't it be great to be 25 again?
Well,
no,
yeah.
it wouldn't be.
Yeah, right. Turns out, no.
Right. So people get basically, you know, research shows that people become what I would call emotionally wiser as they get older. You know, you kind of know better, you know, sort of what makes you happy, what doesn't make you happy. You tend to spend time with people that make you happy as opposed to sort of people who make you unhappy. You actually take fewer risks when you're older. That's one reason that – so there are pros and cons to that, but there's one reason that you're happier because you're, you know, one of my favorite studies, for example, asked young and old people, if you could have lunch, you know, say next week with anyone you want, your favorite author, your favorite, you know, celebrity, versus anyone else, who would you have lunch with? And young people overwhelmingly chose like their favorite author. Older people chose, you know, my sister,
mm-hmm.
my best friend, right? So it's like they know that they would have a great time with those people and they are, you know, and they would rather not take that risk.
Mm-hmm. So, well, in a way, it also seems a little more reality-based, which makes sense. They've had more
yeah,
reality.
That's right. But anyway, so older people are somewhat happier than younger people.
Okay, income and wealth.
Right. Those are two different things, but
yeah.
they're both related to happiness. So people who are wealthier, who have higher incomes, are happier than people who are not. And it's actually kind of surprising because it's you see the relationship at pretty much every level. I mean, someone who makes $1 million a year is happier than someone who makes, you know, $700,000 a year. But that difference is just not very big. I mean, so there is this correlation, but it's a small correlation. So it turns out the biggest jump really is when you have your basic needs met. You know, if you're poor, you don't have your basic needs met. You worry about, you know, your rent. You worry about having food on the table, you know, living in a safe neighborhood, et cetera. That makes you very unhappy. Once you have your basic needs met, then more money just makes you just a little bit happier. And then one of the reasons for that is something as a major theme of my book, which is called hedonic adaptation, which
yeah.
is the idea that we adapt to what we have. You know, we make more money, we get a raise, we move into a bigger house, we buy a nicer car, and we get used to it. We start taking it for granted. Then we want even more and more and more and more. And so that's one reason that income doesn't correlate with happiness as much as you think it does.
Okay. Education.
You know, I have never seen any correlations with education. Zero correlation with education and happiness.
Okay. Health.
Health is definitely related to happiness, especially self-reported health. If you ask people on a scale of 1 to 10, how healthy are you? Now, there might be some bias involved in answering that question, right? If you're an unhappy person, you sort of rate everything negatively. but yes, but the biggest issue there is if you're in chronic pain. So it's almost impossible to be happy when you're in pain. Not surprising and very unfortunate. And also, if you have a condition or an illness that's deteriorating. So those are the most unhappy people. When there's uncertainty and when there's deterioration, people can get used to almost anything. So if you become disabled, like let's say you lose a leg or you lose your eyesight, it's really traumatic at first, but people get used to it over time and they can lead happy, full lives. But if you have a condition that's sort of worsening, then you never get used to it.
Okay. Urban versus rural. Do you have research on that or not?
Oh, yes. The studies that I've seen recently show that people urban are less happy than rural. Now, there's so many reasons for that,
sure.
Right? I mean, the type of people who move into urban areas, you know, there's sort of self-selection there. But yes, there's more stress, you can say. But yeah, urban less happy than rural.
Right. There's also probably more comparison in urban than
sure, there's
rural.
So many factors.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
I agree.
And you already mentioned about single versus married, but go into some of the nuances of that one.
Well, you know, married people are definitely happier than people who are, you know, widowed or divorced or separated, and that's not surprising. But it turns out that lifelong single people, and by the way, when you say married, we're talking about people who've been married, who are not like on their third or fourth marriage. You know, they've been married consistently. So consistently married versus consistently single, there's no difference in happiness. And it's really interesting. I mean, people who are lifelong singles, there's been studies, for example, of women who are lifelong single women, and they're very happy, as I said, or they're not any less happy. They have many, many very close friendships, lots of sort of activities, work, hobbies that they get a lot of meaning from. So, you know, it's just not the case that you need an intimate partner to be happy.
And in fact, didn't you find or haven't they found that single people have more friends?
Yes, exactly. So I think single people tend to have, or the sort of a lifelong kind of single person has like an average of about a dozen, you know, kind of lifelong close friendships, which is amazing. I mean, how many,
yeah,
those of us who are married with children, you know, how many of us can claim to have a dozen friends with which we keep, you know, very regular touch with?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay, so we just touched into that one. Childless versus having children. And here, please go into when you first have them and then when they leave, you know, all the different things
right,
that you've learned, because I think that's very fascinating.
Sure, sure. Well, lots of research on this. This is actually a topic of research that my graduate students and I are working on right now. Well, in terms of sort of what happens when you have kids, so when you get pregnant with your first child, you have your first child, there's sort of a boost in happiness, very exciting. Then there tends to be a decrease because it's so hard.
Mm-hmm.
But then you kind of go back. So basically, there's not a huge difference over time. But then the hardest part is when you have children under age 5. Not the hardest part, one of the hardest parts. So people are quite unhappy, especially their marital happiness or relationship happiness, is that it's sort of fairly low state at that point. Then having teenagers is also an unhappy time in terms of, especially in terms of marital happiness.
And it's unhappy for both of you, isn't it? I mean, it's unhappy for the teenager and the parents.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I have both teenagers and little ones. So it's sort of a double whammy, but I don't know. I'm pretty happy. But and then the empty nest is a time of sort of greater happiness. Now, these studies are all a little bit problematic because they're all correlational. You can't do experiments on, you know, making some people have kids and forbidding
right,
other people to have kids.
Right.
So, but overall, I should say that parents report more meaning in their life than people who don't have children. And we find that certain kinds of parents, especially fathers, parents who are relatively older, who are married, who are employed, are happier than people who do not have children. Okay. But, like, for example, young parents and single parents don't tend to be happier than non-parents.
Okay. Religious or spiritual versus non-religious?
Right.
And if it breaks down where actual religion is different from just someone who would say spiritual but not religious.
You know, I find that it doesn't seem to break down. Sort of whether you're just religious or spiritual, people are happier than people who are not. But the key question is really why. And it, you know, it's really two reasons. And one is that religious people and spiritual people too tend to have better social support. They might have more stronger relationships, sort of a bigger community to rely on, especially in times of stress or adversity. And they also report more purpose in life that also helps them deal with adversity. So it doesn't mean, so if you're not religious or spiritual, it doesn't mean you can't have social support and you can't have meaning, but it's just that those are sort of the two things that kind of come, are more likely to come with being a religious person.
Mm-hmm. Is there any studies on liberals or progressives versus conservatives?
Well, you know, I was just going to say, well, you didn't ask me about Democrats versus Republicans.
Yeah. And I had Chris Mooney on to talk about the Republican brain versus the, you know, progressive brain. But what about happiness?
Well, there's a fairly recent study published that showed the Republicans are happier than Democrats.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, this particular study, I don't know if it really needs to be replicated, but this study showed that or suggested that one of the reasons the Republicans were happier is that they had a greater tolerance for inequality. So, and I don't really buy that. I think that there's just so many differences between Republicans and Democrats that I kind of doubt that explains the difference. It also sort of makes it sound very negative. But anyway, there it is. There's a slight difference between Republicans and Democrats.
Men versus women.
No difference.
Uh-huh.
Except, so in overall happiness, but there are differences in kind of emotion fluctuation. So you may not be surprised that women have higher highs and lower lows. They're more likely to fluctuate, right? They kind of go up and down. And men are much more stable.
Okay. Americans versus people from other countries.
Well, that really depends on the country. So the Scandinavian countries, the people who live there tend to report that they're the happiest in the world. But there's some other countries like Latin American countries, sort of countries that are very collectivist, that are very much focused on family, you know, and social life, very close relationships, they tend to be happy. This is all related also to things like GDP and democracy. So countries that are more democratic and that are wealthier are also happier.
That's the voice of Sonia Lyubomirsky, and we're talking about happiness, and which is what she studies, and her newest book is The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't and What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. And her website where you can learn more is Dr. Sonia, DrSonja, drsonja.net. Okay, do you, when you're studying happiness, do you merely want to know what happens? That is, what events stimulate what neurotransmitters? Or do you want to know why? And if you want to know why, is that something that's possible to study?
I definitely want to know why. So, and in fact, even though I do what I call happiness interventions, that, you know, studies that try to make people happier, I'm actually more interested in sort of why do they work? Why is it that people get happier when they express gratitude, and how does that work? And I have sort of a couple of theories about that. And it is possible to study. So for example, we might do a study where we ask people to write letters of gratitude every week. But then we measure a lot of other things to see, well, what is it that gratitude is doing? I mean, why is it that gratitude makes people happy? And so for example, we found that people who express gratitude report more positive events in their life. So imagine writing a letter to your mother and thanking her, you know, for, you know, everything she did for you, or writing a letter the next week to your former mentor or teacher. You know, but what does that do? I mean, that could actually create positivity in your life, right? It could actually get you closer, make you feel closer to your parents or your mentors or your friends. So it creates positive events in your life by, you know, being grateful. So anyway, so we study the how and we study the why of happiness.
Now, how much of the why in your studies or in the broader field do people end up looking for answers in biology and evolution, evolutionary psychology? In other words, there's, you know, the whole thing of we notice negative events more because survival
right.
dictated. It was more important to know what might go wrong than what might go right, et cetera.
Right. So I think researchers are beginning to do this and to ask these questions and investigate. But it's really, this is all kind of at the embryonic stages. So, I mean, I'm fascinated with evolutionary psychology and questions like what you're talking about. You know, why is it that we're more attuned to negative things, you know, and yes, it's adaptive for us to sort of notice the snake afoot, right? Why is it that we're attuned to novelty as opposed to familiarity, right? It's because novelty might be a signal of either a danger or a reward in there, or an opportunity in the environment. And so those are really, really interesting things to think about. In terms of biology and neuroscience, you know, a very interesting work going on, but it's mostly just correlational. It's just sort of like, well, people who are happier, their brains might look a little bit different. Now, what does that mean? So if your brain, if an area lights up in your brain when you're happier, you know, we don't really know what that means. You know, is that a symptom of something? I wouldn't say that that's a why. You know, that's just you know, it's just a correlate. It's a correlation. So the science is just too young, I think, to answer those why questions, but I'm very excited to sort of see what the future will bring.
And how will that science mature? In something like what you're doing, well, we'll do better experiments and we'll, you know, get clearer about what the variables are and so on. But when you're trying to figure out the evolutionary utility of something, does it ever go beyond a really good imagination?
Right. I don't know. I mean, evolutionary theory, you know, you can't do experiments, you know, testing or very hard to do experiments testing evolutionary hypotheses. So it's always a theory. It's always sort of post hoc, although it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And you can try to validate your conclusions or your interpretations. And then with biology, you know, again, I'm really not trained in those fields, so it's hard for me to answer those questions. So I don't know. All I can say is I'm excited. Like every decade brings like a whole new sort of set of findings and questions. So I just feel like, you know, I'm excited to see what the next decade will bring.
Yeah, yeah. I got a couple of big questions, and then we'll go to a couple of, if we have time, a couple of just the sort of interesting things for listeners. But is there something naive or self-defeating about the whole self-help, happiness, positive psychology field? And let me just set this up. Given the enormous and growing inequality of wealth and income, political power in U.S. society, for instance, shouldn't people be unhappy or angry? And can some of this be pacification of people who – I remember James Hillman and Michael Ventura wrote a book years ago. We've had 100 years of, you know, psychoanalysis, and now we don't know how angry we should be, kind of. That wasn't the title, but basically the – what's your thought on that?
Right. No, that is interesting. So it could be kind of like the opium of the masses, right?
Mm-hmm,
so like,
mm-hmm.
Things aren't so good, so we just – why don't we all just try to be grateful for what we have, right?
Exactly. If we can get all these middle class people that are losing, you know, what they thought they were going to have to just do more random acts of kindness, they won't notice.
Yeah, they won't notice that they're – but I don't agree with that. And the reason is the research shows that it's the happiest people who are going to be most likely to change the world in a sense. They're the ones who have more energy, motivation, ideas, creativity. They're healthier. They're more productive. They're more active. I mean, if you're unhappy, you're going to sit on the couch and do nothing. You know, that depressed people don't go out and join, you know, movements. If you're a little depressed, if you're very depressed, you're just going to sit on your couch. So the happiest people they're going to see oppression and they're going to want to do something about it, right? They're going to see inequality. They're going to do something about it. So I don't completely agree with that, but it's a point well taken.
It seems like one of the most fascinating sort of areas of study, because if we are going to improve society and not just the, you know, the moment to moment happiness of each other, the way those things fit together seems to be an interesting one. So what you're saying is that the person who makes change is someone who notices what's wrong, has the itch, if you will,
mm-hmm.
but has the feeling of self-efficacy, mm-hmm. to actually take it on.
That's right. So happier people are more optimistic, they're more confident, they're more motivated, they're more energetic. They're the ones who are going to take on those big challenges. So I think that's one reason that it's good for us to try to become happier.
Now, there's another side to this. Does the message that you're responsible for your happiness, and let me put a preface to that, which is the research, if I'm not mistaken, says that happiness is influenced 50% by genes, which I think would really surprise some people, 10% by demographic and circumstantial factors. That's wealth, income, whether you have a job or not. And then 40% seems to be what we have some control of, no matter the circumstances or the genes. Is that pretty correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if now you tell me, well, you're responsible for your happiness, does that make people more likely to think unhappiness is their fault? And can that create a vicious cycle of, you know, I should be able to fix this?
Yeah. I mean, that is definitely a danger. That is a danger with any kind of research that involves sort of self-improvement, right? So if you don't do these things, then it is your fault. But on the other hand, you know, the 50% genetic, you know, basically that research comes from twin studies showing that people who are identical twins are much more similar in their happiness levels than our fraternal twins. I mean, 50% is a lot. I mean, it's not 100%, but it's a lot.
And
it is
a lot.
Those of us who have more than one child often notice, gee, I feel like I treat them the same, you know, I raise them the same, and some of my kids are just less happy than others. So, I mean, that at least that should make people feel not so bad and not blame themselves. It's so much of it is genetic. But, you know, there are things you can do. You know, some people don't want to become happier. They feel like happy people see the world with rose-colored glasses, and they see the world as it truly is, you know. So, and that's fine. You know what? If someone doesn't want to become happier, I'm not going to persuade them otherwise.
Yeah, if they're happy being unhappy, who's to
– right.
Right. You've got about a minute. What minute and a half? What's the sort of – have you found – in working in this area and in, let's say, touring on this book and so on, the thing that you want people to, you know, if you have a minute to tell people something that might help them, what would it be?
Okay. So one is, yes, you can become happier if you want to be. Another is it takes effort. It takes a lot of work to improve your emotional life, to be happier, to improve your relationships. You know, just like with any goal in life, it takes work. So you have to put the effort into it if you care about it. And then the importance of fit, we sort of touched on this a bit, is that if you want to be happier, you have to sort of find what works for you. I mean, some people hear about, you know, trying to be grateful and they think, oh, that's so hokey. You know, I don't want to do that. That doesn't, you know, whatever. It's not going to work for me. So that's fine. You know, do something else. You know, try to, you know, learn a new skill, go traveling, you know, go do more exercise, get involved in spiritual activities, you know, whatever is sort of floats your boat, basically. So that's the idea of fit. So fit is important and effort is important. But most important, you know, you can become happier and look at what the science says. You know, I think that it's very important to go by empirical evidence. If you want to spend a lot of time doing something, make sure that it's validated.
Okay. And so that would – one way to do that is The How of Happiness, Sonia's first book, and The Myths of Happiness, her next book, some of those other books she recommended. And I think this is just you know, to me, this is exciting stuff. As we referred to briefly, when I was in college studying this stuff, talking in the mid-60s, this was brand new. I mean, brand new, the notion that psychology was about anything but the negative. And so it's very exciting to see what we're learning. The book is The Myths of Happiness, What Should Make You Happy But Doesn't, What Shouldn't Make You Happy But Does. The website is drsonja.net, drsonja.net. Thank you, Sonia Lyubomirsky. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Great to talk to you.
You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. You can do both of those things at iTunes or at my site. For podcast articles and transcripts, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, including looking at my work with story and narrative in organizations, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues and usually 3 or 4 articles of background, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production. And to you, my listeners, I look forward to being with you again next week.